The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have Anthony McCarthy in the studio today. Of course, he's host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, heard every Friday here from 5 to 7 p.m. on WEAA. And our first guest together will be Senator Ben Cardin. And we'll bring him and that conversation to you when we return to talk about health care, what's going on in Iran, and more. And hear you asking questions as his constituents. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But before we can get to that, let's get you all home safe and turn this over to WEAA traffic. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Urbanite Radio stories on The Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or bsmusic.org. I'm Mark Steiner. It's good to have you with us. Anthony McCarthy, co-host at least once a week, is with us in the house. Welcome.
I look forward to it. We always have a great time and great, great guests like this hour.
This hour, we're going to start this. We're going to be talking about the flu and stuff in the next hour. We're going to be looking at state politics in the latter part of this hour with a guest from the Gazette, the Annapolis bureau chief, talking about a story that's not really in the sun yet, but that we will be talking about, which is the possibility, the rumors, that Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown may be departing the state government, leaving room open for somebody else who's in elected office to become lieutenant governor. We'll talk more about that later in the hour. But we are joined now at 410-319-8888, by the way, is the number here. Senator Ben Cardin is going to join us in the first part of this half hour, joining us from Capitol Hill, where he's representing us. And Senator, are you there? I guess he's not there yet. Okay. All right, we'll get to Senator Cardin in just a minute, 410-319-8888. But there's a lot to talk about here with Senator Cardin. I want folks to join us with their thoughts. Two issues we'll talk about with him are health care and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Health care.
You know, Mark, it's very interesting as you've been updating me all day. I don't know how you find time to do all this research and do all this reading, but it's fascinating as we've watched the Finance Committee make some moves today, including we talked in our production meeting earlier today about Olympia Snow, the Republican, may be willing to come on board with some of Baucus's plan. But there are so many amendments, of course, as well as watching what some people are predicting in the Senate, the death of a public option.
Well, the Senate Finance Committee, just before we went on the air, I guess about an hour ago now, the Senate Finance Committee under Max Baucus rejected Senator Jay Rockefeller's fairly comprehensive public plan that he was going to put into the health proposal, and lost by a vote of 15-8, if I have it right, a number of Democrats voting with Republicans to kill that bill. When we talk to the senator, I mean, one of the questions is, if with a 60-member Democratic majority, why is it so hard to get these things done?
And Mark, it seems like there is not the consensus in the Democratic caucus that a lot of people believed, including a lot of progressives who have really, you know, they didn't expect Max Baucus or this very conservative finance committee to lurch to the left. But they thought that Democrats, given their majority and with the recent appointment of Senator Kirk from Massachusetts, that the Democrats would have not only the votes, but have the will to move a public option and move health care out of the Senate. Obama said yesterday, the president said yesterday, he wants this done this year. He wants it done, preferably in his mind, before Thanksgiving. I'm not sure if the Finance Committee or the Senate is going to be able to move that quickly.
Well, what we know is that the senators, that the Democratic senators, Tom Carper of Delaware, Ken Conrad of North Dakota, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, and Bill Nelson of Florida joined all 10 Republicans opposing Senator Rockefeller's public option within the bill being put forth, a community choice health plan being put forth by Senator Baucus. And then another bill that was even more watered down that was submitted by Senator Schumer was also defeated by a narrow margin, but also defeated on the Senate Finance Committee. And the question is why, and where are we going with this health care? Pardon me for kicking this mic. Number here is 410-319-8888. I just understand that Senator Cardin is now with us. Senator Ben Cardin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, it's always a pleasure to be on your show. Hope everything's well.
And with you?
Everything's going well.
Good. Had a good new year?
Very nice.
Good.
Thank you. Same to you.
Did. I had a wonderful one. It was a good 10 days.
You all have great New Year's.
We know how to celebrate. But
we know how to celebrate.
It ends with a day where we can't eat.
That's right.
It ends with fasting. Number is 410-319-8888. And Senator Anthony McCarthy co-hosts with me here on Mondays and Tuesdays sometimes. He's with us today. So I want to let you know he's in his house as well. talk to us first about what happened today. I know this is not your committee, I know, but the Senate Finance Committee rejected Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia's amendment to ensure a strong public plan. That was kind of, maybe not shocking the vote took place, but talk to us about the politics of why it's so difficult for a public plan to get a foothold in the Senate, in the House, in the Senate Finance Committee, when clearly the vast majority of Americans are for it.
Well, also understand that another Senate committee has reported a bill that includes a public insurance option, the Senate Health Committee. These two bills need to be merged, and the majority leader will be responsible for doing that. Ultimately, it's going to be decided on the floor of the United States Senate or in a conference committee, so we're not yet at the final action. The Senate Finance Committee is a bit more conservative, the Democratic membership on that, than representative in the Senate Democratic Caucus as a whole. Having said that, I'm not sure why this is a conservative, progressive issue. To me, having a public insurance option will help bring down the cost to the taxpayers of this country, which I would hope fiscal conservatives would agree is a good thing to do. Medicare is a public insurance option. I don't hear a lot of conservative Republicans suggesting that we eliminate Medicare. Medicare is not only a popular program, it's been a cost-effective program for seniors' health care. So for all those reasons, I'm not sure why we're having this contentious debate on this one part of the health care reform issues. I would hope at the end of the day we would have a public insurance option because, to me, it'll bring down cost.
Let's talk about it just for a bit more. I mean, I do want to spend some time talking about Iran in the course of our time with you, and also open the phones at 410-319-8888 to all of our listeners across the state of Maryland to have a chance to talk to their Senator, Ben Cardin, who joins Anthony McCarthy and I here right now on WEAA. But the Senate Health Committee, which is going to, as you say, put forth another bill. Tom Harkin is the chair. Our own Barb Mikulski is on that committee. And it does have a kind of a more liberal bent, with Jack Reed, Bernard Sanders, and Al Franken, and some others who are on that committee. So tell us about that process and how it's going to work. What's going to happen between these two committees? Because the press is all going is talking about nothing but Baucus and his committee.
Yeah. First, let me say hello to Anthony. It's nice to be on a show with you. I'm sorry we're not there in person.
That's all right. Great to talk to you, Senator.
Good to have you. The process is like any other bill. There's hearings and marked up in the committee. The Senate Health Committee must have spent 3 weeks in marking up the bill. It was the longest markup in the history of the Health Committee. There were 500-plus amendments that were offered. Many were accepted from both Republicans and Democrats. The bill reflects, I think, the best input from all the members of the committee, including our own Senator Barbara Mikulski. The bill is very strong on preventive care, on better use of health information technology, in dealing with individuals' medical needs so that there is less readmissions to hospitals for those who have serious illnesses, that there's better management. We bring down the cost. There's a lot of good stuff that's in the Health Committee bill, and we hope that most of that will survive the merging between the Senate Finance Committee bill and the Senate Health Committee bill.
Senator, how important is compromise in this ongoing debate in the Senate? A lot of people talking about the fact that no Republicans have signed on. Olympia Snow giving some indications that she's very interested in moving in that direction. But how important you know, progressives, let me put it this way, progressives in the House, as well as a lot of progressive organizations, are really frustrated with Democrats. They believe that you all have the votes to be much more aggressive than a lot of Democrats are being. Is that a fair characterization?
To a certain degree, I agree with that, but I must tell you, compromise is part of the legislative process.
Most definitely.
And all of us need to be a little pragmatic in getting a bill done. What we should not compromise are three basic principles, and let me just outline them. Healthcare reform needs to bring down the growth rate of healthcare costs. We got to contain costs. That cannot be compromised. If it doesn't bring down healthcare costs, then it's not doing its job. Number two, we must make sure that every American family has access to affordable, quality health insurance and healthcare. Now that we can't compromise that. There's got to be an affordable product there. It's one of the reasons why we fight so hard for a public insurance option, to make sure there's an affordable product. Are there other ways to do it? Yes. Does it cost more money? Yes. Which brings me to the third point. And the third point is that this bill needs to be done in a fiscally prudent way that doesn't add to the deficit of the country. And there are three principles that we will not compromise. Yes, we'll sit down and compromise on a lot of the provisions of the bill. And there's a lot of that's in total agreement, like reforming health insurance and making sure insurance companies can't discriminate based upon an individual's health condition, and no caps on coverage, and no gaps here, and no deductibles or copayments on preventive care. They're all that's agreed to. There's really not a much disagreement. So, I think that Congress will provide for universal coverage. That's one of the things that progressives have been fighting for a long time. So I think there's a lot to celebrate where there's consensus, but there is some disagreements, and we're going to try to do our best. No one ever pretended that the Democratic Party was monolithic. We're not. You know, we have a broad tent. We believe that you can be conservative and be a Democrat. After all, I think most of us are fiscal conservatives. We want to be. So let's try to bring this together, and let's really emphasize what keeps us together as a party, and let's work out our differences.
This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to Senator Ben Cardin, who's joining Anthony McCarthy and I here this hour, on this first part of our show, in this first hour of the Mark Steiner Show, at 410-319-8888. Before I bring in some questions here for the senator, and also get some thoughts in about Iran before he has to leave, let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. And Michael, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Really quick, Senator Cardin, you're a friend of ours in the state of Maryland, and I wanted to make sure you are aware of a study that came out from the great state of Maryland, both from the Johns Hopkins Institute, University of Rada, and University of Maryland and GW, that talks in very hard fiscal terms around something that's usually talked about in squishy terms, and that's health inequity. And so we talked about inequity that exists in the country, and these researchers used very, very standard data and very, very conservative methodologies. And their conclusion was that between 2003 and 2006, $1.24 trillion was the combined cost of health inequities and premature death in the U.S. to minorities, and that the direct cost alone to Medicare medical expenses was $229 billion, some other estimates for cost of premature death and indirect costs.
So, Michael, there's something wrong with the connection. I don't know what it is, but what is the question that you want to ask the senator about that?
So the question is with that hard data, that there's money that can be saved to the country in terms of paying for the cost. Where is the discussion of health equity in this debate, given that this was just released by the Joint Center with Secretary Sebelius and a number of other legislators? Because it seems to me that would be one way to swing the pendulum backwards to the fiscal argument.
Well, thank you for the question. You're absolutely correct. Health disparity in America is not only morally wrong, it's not only legally wrong, it's costly. And we need to deal with the health disparity issues. The infant mortality rate is two times higher for an African-American baby than it is for the rest of the population. That should trouble all of us. We need to do a better job on it. Those who do not have health insurance are far more likely to have problems in our healthcare system that are not dealt with than people who do have health insurance. And that's an income disparity in America, and that's wrong, and that's costing us as people use emergency rooms that are much more expensive and don't get the preventive health care that would help them deal with serious diseases. It's costly, and it's wrong, and we need to address it. So we very much have raised the health disparity issues. I could give you a lot more examples about heart disease and the racial disparities there. I could give you statistics on oral health care, dental care, and how that breaks down. These are issues that need to be dealt with. The bills that are moving through the Congress do deal with the disparity issues.
A very quick question, Senator Benton, before you have to run, and I do want to get a question, at least in about Iran, before you have to go, about what's going to happen with that and the meeting coming up in Geneva in just a few days. But there are some people arguing about our healthcare situation now that the current bills that are in front of both House and the Senate, that don't really kind of answer the questions of the healthcare crisis. I mean, they're not talking about cost controls for insurance companies. They're not making sure that everyone is covered. Nothing's about drug prices. No real definition of covered benefits. What I've seen from the public plan so far, it's not even implemented in 2013, and is only about taking care of the sickest, which is a good way to destroy the program by 2017 or 2018, when you have to redebate some things. And I think there are a lot of issues here that this bill, many arguing, some people in the press arguing, that is a bill that really benefits the insurance companies more than it does the citizens of this country.
Well, I disagree with that. First of all, again, there are five committees that are reporting bills. We'll wait to see what the final versions look like. But there are strong provisions that are coming out of our committees that deal with health insurance reform and dealing with the practices, including reporting their loss ratios so you can know exactly how much of your premium dollar is going into benefits and how much is going into the profits of insurance companies. We're asking for transparency there. There's a lot in here to bring down costs as far as preventive care is concerned and better use of health information technology. And so there's a lot in here that is dealing with the problems that you are suggesting. There's universal coverage. Most of the committees are requiring that everyone have health insurance. There's some waivers on the Senate Finance Committee bill, but it's not a significant number that would qualify for the waiver. So, yes, everybody's going to have health insurance. We're going to have one system for everybody in this country. And, yes, I support a public insurance option for many of the reasons that you raised in your questions. So we know that there is a guaranteed affordable option available to every person in this country. But so I think that the it's being framed in a way that we can make tremendous progress in providing access to affordable quality care for every American.
Senator, I want to ask you, and I know Mark probably has questions about this as well, and I know your time is limited. There was a piece in the New York Times over the weekend that was very compelling. It essentially said that the Obama administration had kind of been very tentative and somewhat sloppy in dealing with Iran. And the president of Iran saying, look, you know, we're open to inspections, but we're not going to have our nuclear plants and exploration limited. And that every time he's reached out to this administration, we, you know, talk about reaching back, but the president has been very tentative, and that the United States is in a position to really lead the world in how we deal with Iran, and that sanctions are just a real missed opportunity, and that we should be a bit more aggressive in dealing with Iran. Give me your thoughts on that, especially with this meeting coming up on Thursday in Geneva.
Well, clearly the jury's out here. We're still not at the point, but I think the president's had a pretty good week in dealing with Iran. He's gotten more international support, recognizing the seriousness of the issue. The truth is that the best option for stopping Iran from becoming a nuclear weapons power is through the international community being united so Iran changes its policy, and that means willing to impose very, very tough sanctions. And I think the president has taken very concrete steps to achieve those goals, which the former administration was unable to do. So I really do believe that President Obama deserves high marks for at least establishing the climate for a discussion with Iran where they know they have one of two choices. They either change their habits on developing nuclear weapon capacity, or they're going to have the wrath of the international community that could very well cripple their already crippled economy. In Iran today, 40% of the people are unemployed. If we can stop the refined oil products from going into Iran, their economy will even be more jeopardized. And why do we want to do that? Not to penalize the people of Iran, to make it clear that Iran cannot use its economy to produce a nuclear weapon. And that's what they're doing today. So I think that's our best chance of success. The president understands it. He's moving in that direction.
I don't know if you've seen the things that both Chita Parsi has been writing, or that Flint Everett and Hillary Mann Leverett wrote in the articles today in the New York Times, their op-ed piece. They're both former members of the National Security Council. But, I mean, one of the things they're saying is, A, we don't know, you can't ensure that, A, because Russia and China will probably not go along with this meeting is with Iran and the five Security Council members of the UN, Russia, China, Britain, France, the United States of America.
And Germany.
And that they may not go along with that at all. And that, B, that we are taking a negative, which is instead of kind of trying to pull them into a civil nuclear program, that instead we are kind of making them prove that they're not developing weapons, and that this article is arguing, and this is the people who support Barack Obama are arguing, that he's beginning to take this same position as President Bush did, and that the nuances are very slight, and it's very different from what he was talking about when he was running for president.
Well, Mark, look, I'm not sure what are the other options here. There is no question in the minds of those who have studied the situation that Iran is taking steps to enrich uranium beyond what is needed for nuclear energy. That they're doing it in order to have the capacity to build a nuclear weapon, either for their own potential defense or use, or for bargaining with other countries in potentially providing nuclear weapon capacity to either factions or countries in that region. There's also general agreement that if that were to occur, the balance in the Middle East equation changes, and we may very well see a nuclear arms race with other countries in that region becoming nuclear aspirants for a weapon, such as Egypt, such as Saudi Arabia, because they feel threatened by Iran. That, again, causes a stability issue in that region, which is very, very much against U.S. interest. So it's in our interest to do everything we can to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear weapons power. The best option by far is for Iran to comply with its international agreements, allow inspection, and for us to see whether that can work. There is reason to believe that can work, and I think that's what President Obama is attempting to do. He's attempting to get through to the Iranian regime, which is already under siege by its own people, to allow international inspection, which would include this new site that the United States has brought forward proof, to make sure they're complying with the international agreements on nonproliferation. If they agree to do that, then we're fine. We're not anxious to have a confrontation either on economic sanctions with Iran or elsewhere, otherwise. And we want to work with the international community. All indications we have is that Russia wants us to succeed. They don't want Iran to become a nuclear weapons power. So what the president has done with Russia is say, look, we don't see you as a military threat against us. We see the Middle East more of a threat. You've misunderstood our arms issues as it relates to Poland and as it relates to Czech Republic. So let's talk about that as to what we want to do with our shield, and that may very well help us getting Russia's support for dealing with Iran. I mean, I think the president's handling this the way I want the president to handle this. He's giving us our best chance of changing the current plans in Iran.
There are, in this whole debate over Iran, one of the things that has been written about is that China would be the most difficult nation to get to go along with this, because they would like to see a pipeline for hydrocarbons and more go from Iran to China through the former Soviet Asian republics. And I guess what I'm just trying to ask you about this is that not that we don't have to deal with nuclear proliferation in this world, and we do.
Right.
But the question is that it seems as if we're negotiating with Iran from a position that causes more hostility than it does figuring out a way to get them into the fold. Because, you know, I mean, it's the same thing when President Nixon went to China.
Right.
Even when we were fighting the Vietnam War and the Chinese were helping the North Vietnamese, we backed off from going after China to create this rapprochement with them.
Well, I think we clearly have the support of our traditional allies in Europe. I think the president's working very hard to get Russia's support for tougher sanctions against Iran. And if Iran sees that, then they know that there's a more serious consequence to their current policies. And the general thought is that if you get Russia, China has many other issues. They're not. This is not one they will draw a line in the sand on, and they don't like to be out of step with the other nations on the Security Council. So I think there is at least a reasonable belief that tough sanctions could be imposed. And if Iran believes that, in fact, is the case, there is a good chance, there's certainly a reasonable chance, that Iran would change their policies. And that's, as I understand it, the Obama strategy, which I think is the best option they could put on the table. Again, I guess I'll turn the question around. Do you have a better option?
I don't. I'm not running the diplomacy of this country, but I think that one of the things that I've been really taken with by some of the leading Iranian thinkers on Iranian policy is that we should be doing things to, within the framework of the international community, to kind of help them develop a civil nuclear program to kind of go to bring them in a positive vein rather than attacking Iran, which doesn't seem to have worked in any administration, nor has it budged this authoritarian regime from power. And that we have to find some other ways of doing it. And then when you have sanctions always end up hurting those who have the least in those societies and not the wealthy and not the people in power.
I may argue with you. If you look at the South African example, I think sanctions brought down the apartheid government of South Africa. I think it was the economics that brought down the apartheid government, ultimately allowing that country to develop the way it should without bloodshed. So I think that you got to be selective. I couldn't agree with you more. And the concept of sanctions is the threat. Hopefully you don't need to apply them. In Iran's case, they have shown willingness in the past to alter their behavior when they thought the international community was serious.
One last thing before we have to go, so I'm about to take a break and you've got to get going, right. Is that if it came to the floor for a vote on the health care bill and there was no strong, viable public option, and I'm not even going from zero to dropping Medicare down to zero because that's not probably going to happen in this public option, could you vote for a plan without a viable public option?
I will be supporting a plan if it accomplishes the three goals I spelled out. It's got to be able to bring down the cost of health care. It's got to be every American family has to have access to affordable quality care, and it's got to be done in a fiscally responsible way that doesn't add to the deficit. If it accomplishes those goals, I will support it. It's a lot easier to see that done with a public insurance option.
Senator Ben Cardin, Anthony McCarthy, and myself, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for
always good to talk to you. Senator Ben Cardin has been our guest in the first part of this program. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about these issues and more. Have you join us here at 410-319-8888. Take a look at what's going on behind the scenes in Annapolis in the future of our state politics, which is facing a huge deficit crisis and more. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. And before we leap into the heart of our program here, I want to remind you to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore, Thursday, October the 8th from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the historic Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket price will benefit WEAA, so do not miss the boat. Tickets are available by calling 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT, which translates into 1-800-695-2628. or go online at weaa.org. And we're not sailing. Well, we are, as a matter of fact, after a fashion. Anthony McCarthy are both in the studio here. And Anthony McCarthy, of course, hosts his own show here every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. My God, 5 to 7 p.m. on 88.9, the voice of the community. So we just finished talking to Senator Ben Cardin. 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts out there about all this and on health care and where we're going? What do you think?
Mark, I'd be very curious to hear from our listeners. I think that what we heard from Senator Cardin and what we're hearing from Democrats who voted against Senator Rockefeller's amendment, which had a very comprehensive public option plan, I think that when Senator Cardin laid out those 3 points about cost containment, making sure that it's universal, that all Americans have access to affordable I forget the other phrase he used, but and that it was fiscally prudent. I'm not sure how you have a piece of legislation, whether it's the final version when the House and Senate versions go to conference committee. I'm not sure how you meet those three criteria without a public option. But it's clear that Ben Cardin, Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland, and others are ready to vote on health care legislation that may not have a strong public option in it. And so I'm not sure how universal it actually can be without that compromise. And he had all of the talking points down pat, and I think he's very effective. But this idea, Mark, that compromise is got to take place for us to reach some sort of legislation that we can get out that is the most effective. I'm wondering, I was thinking about the story, Mark, that appeared in The Sun where 1 in 5 Baltimore families were in poverty last year. And I'm not sure if you cannot find a health care reform plan, if you can't get one out of Congress that speaks to poor people's ability to get quality coverage, I'm not sure where the Democrats are going. I'm at a loss to understand where they're going.
What's amazing to me, and we didn't get Ben Cardin could only stay half an hour, but I wanted to ask him, maybe I should ask him at the top, is what we both talked about, but we didn't ask him, I don't know where our brains were, but about what is going on with the Democrats. 60-vote majority in the U.S. Senate, and you can't get this thing passed. And the majority of Americans, what is it, I saw last poll, 56% support a public plan. Only 38% are really steadfast against it. And we can't seem to get this off the ground. And I think that Michael Moore today, along with Roseanne DeMauro, who heads the California Nurses Union, put together an article that was in Common Dreams. It was in Huffington Post, I mean to say. And the California Nurses Association uncovered data that found that 6 of the biggest insurers rejected on average more than 1/5 of all the claims every year since 2002. And there's nothing in the bill about that. There's nothing in these bills about cost controls for insurance companies. There's nothing in these bills to stop these companies from using marketing techniques to only take healthy people. There are no controls over our drug prices. There's no definition of covered benefits. There's no public safety net. And as we've learned, the public option that's in the House bill doesn't go into effect till 2013. And if you have private insurance, you can't utilize it.
You can't utilize it, which I think a lot of people don't understand that, Mark. I mean, when we talk public option, we're talking about the current plans. Now, as the senator said, let's not rush to judgment because there's still time. But, Mark, when you were kind of educating me about this today and I was reading, people don't understand that there are restrictions about who would even access these options. And so as much as a lot of people are fighting for these options, if you are in a plan, a current existing plan, or if you have some pre-existing condition, you may not be able to access this public option, according to the current debate and the current legislation that's being considered in the House.
It also means that the people the most
vulnerable,
least well off, and the most vulnerable, and the sickest will have the public option, which means it's going to fail financially. So, I mean, this more and more looks like an insurance, health insurance industry bill that benefits them. I mean, part of the public option bill was blew my mind. Part of it is that it will be managed by a private company.
Private company.
So it's not even going to be a public bill. So what do you think, folks? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. And as soon as you get Anthony McCarthy a computer in front of him, you can log on to his page as well. And and we have over 2,000 of you, I think, have joined the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. Log on there now and tell us your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Or the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. And tell us what you think. I put the question out there to all of you right now about that, and I'd like to see just what you think about the health insurance bill, where we are, and why it is where it is. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So I think we have some callers coming in. Let's go to the phones before we get to our next guest coming on. Maria, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Anthony. It's Maria Allwine. I got to tell you, your comments about the Democratic Party are so appropriate. The Democrats have sold out the people who voted for them because, in reality, they're as in the pockets of big business as the Republicans are. I mean, we have a one-party system, and people need to digest that. You know, the Massachusetts model, which is basically what's going to get passed probably, it's a failed model. You can't provide universal insurance coverage. It's not health care. It's insurance coverage to poor people who cannot afford it. And, you know, your point about 1 in 5 living in poverty just here in Baltimore City is so appropriate. They're not going to be able to afford it. And what are they going to do, penalize them? I mean, Massachusetts has found that they cannot fund their universal coverage legislation. They have thrown people off the Medicaid rolls. They are not able to provide insurance that they passed legislation for. It's just not doable. So
the thing that I think, though, that bothers me most about this is that, I mean, that there are, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say that every Democratic elected official is in the pockets of the insurance industry, but I would say that there's enough influence by the insurance companies on Capitol Hill and in their advertising and in their going after the public that they're doing their best to kill a public option and not allow it to become part of this bill. And the issue of a strong public, we're not going to get a single payer system in this Congress this year. But what they could be voting on is a public plan. And that's the option that the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies are working to kill, not to allow a strong public plan, as some have advocated, that you just take Medicare and take it back down to zero and allow people to opt into that if that's what they want. And they want competition. That would be real competition. It seems to me that, you know, when they talk about health insurance companies, talk about, and people who support that talk about, we need freedom of choice. Well, we just need healthcare coverage. Our freedom of choice should be the doctors we want to choose should
That's
be our
right.
choice.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital we want to go to should be our choice. The kind of treatment we want should be our choice. Why do I need to choose an insurance company? That's the issue to me. I'm sorry, Maria, didn't mean to cut you off. Let me let you have a closing thought. We'll go to another caller.
Closing thought is that when we can't even get a strong public option, with the overwhelming majority of his people who voted the Democrats into all three branches of government, or all the two branches of government now, the legislative and the presidency, and you cannot even get a strong public option, that speaks to the absolute degradation of the Democratic Party. They no longer represent the people, and there are far too many of them in the pockets of the pharmaceutical and the healthcare industry on this issue, and it's a disgrace. People really need to wake up to this.
Always good to hear from you, Maria. Thanks so much. What are you pondering there, Anthony?
You know, Mark, the frightening part, and I shouldn't say, maybe frightening is overreaching, that there is the possibility, as Senator Cardin said, that a public option will be included in this final legislation. But it will be so watered down, Mark, that it almost is self-defeating, that it will not be able to cover its expenses, as the president promised. It will not give people who are in dire, dire need the ability to afford the kind of coverage that they need to take care of themselves and their families. And so, therefore, when this period of time comes to reexamine, everyone's going to be able to point to a failure. And so I kind of feel like, well, maybe if we could have an honest conversation about the public option, and I would like for the decision makers to be very honest about how far they're willing to go. I still am reminded, Mark, of how Congresswoman Edwards came on your program last week, and she was adamant that a strong public option is the only option. I'm not sure if Senator Cardin and others have the same kind of enthusiasm for that level of strength when it comes to that public option. Well, and I don't want to make a judgment
call. We have to have them all on at one time. Let's go back to the phones. I think one of our guests is waiting. We'll go to him. But on Facebook, Melanie Hood Wilson just wrote, "I'm outraged." And Valerie Kirkpatrick Breck writes in, "Boo hiss." So thought I'd just read those two to you. And if, please, just go on the Facebook or call us here at 410-319-8888. Bert and Len, if you can hold on, we're going to come back to your calls. So if you just be patient and listen to this next part of the conversation, because we've asked Doug Tillman to join us. Douglas Tallman, is Annapolis Bureau Chief for the Gazette. And I think that the Maryland Gazette is a paper that many people up here in Baltimore don't read, don't know, but you should. Because if you want to know about our state politics, there's no paper that covers it as extensively and as thoroughly as the Gazette. And we'd like to have more of them on this show as we can. Douglas Tallman, welcome. Good to have you with us. Hi, Doug. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. How's it going?
Well, thank you for joining us. So before we go back to our other callers and going back to healthcare, I want to take this segue because we asked you to come on and join us. Because the article you wrote, and by the way, I'm joined by co-host Anthony McCarthy in the studio as well. The article you wrote about the possibilities of Lieutenant Governor Brown leaving the administration, all the rumors floating around. Talk about what you wrote about.
Well, for months, maybe even since the start of the O'Malley administration, there's been some talk about whether speculation about whether Anthony Brown would stick around for 2010. After Obama won, there was some talk about him moving into the Obama administration. And within the last couple of weeks, it's kind of turned up a little bit. And the rumor now was that he'd run for Prince George's executive. His staff denies it. The O'Malley Brown reelection machine denies it. But it's there, and we're definitely talking about it.
That's interesting. Anthony, go ahead.
That component of the PG, Prince George's County Executive, is a new twist that I haven't really heard much about. But a lot of this, Doug, is centered around Jim Smith, the Baltimore County Executive, and who was, I guess for all appearances, appeared to be mounting a campaign against the comptroller, Peter Franchot, and then raised a lot of money, but then announced he wasn't interested in the job. Now, there's been a great deal of speculation that he's going to get something from Governor O'Malley, and some people are saying it's that lieutenant governor slot that Anthony Brown may vacate, whether to run for executive or to take a position somewhere in the Obama administration. What is Jim Smith's folks saying about his relationship with this administration?
He's definitely a loyalist. And as far as what his plans are for 2010, they're being extremely tight-lipped about it.
Any speculations? I know reporters hate to speculate, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, I mean, the way this kind of story came about, folks were kind of connecting some dots, and a lot of this is just, what people do in Annapolis is just kind of come up with this kind of stuff. But, they start looking at the amount of money that Jim Smith has, the amount of, then you base it on the supposition that Martin O'Malley may go into re-election by having to defend these humongous tax increases and a faltering economy. That money may be necessary, unlike other years when a Democratic governor is running for re-election in Maryland. And the best way to move that money into the O'Malley campaign is for Jim Smith to be the running mate.
And is there? I don't know if this is a twist you've looked at all. And we're going to do a show about this in the coming week or two. And I'd like to interview a bunch of folks about this. Is the public defender's office twist that one of the main sources of opposition for Nancy Forrester and the public defender's office came from Baltimore County? Mm-hmm. And Baltimore County has a lot of political sway and money, and Martin O'Malley needs Baltimore County to win this election, the next election. Right. Ehrlich will mount if he runs. I think my gut tells me he really wants to run. And conversations I've had, I think he wants to run. But I think that they need Baltimore County to win that election. And right. that to placate Baltimore County some was one of the reasons we can do away with Nancy Forrester, to get rid of the programs that are a thorn in the side to their prosecutor's office many times, and that this is playing a role in all this. Have you looked right. at it all?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, O'Malley, I guess he won Baltimore County by a few thousand votes,
right.
as I remember.
Right.
Having Jim Smith as the running mate certainly is going to help maintain that, maintain or even better that vote margin. And he may need that as he goes out and, a motivated Republican Party may be able to get more of their flock to vote on, next year. And it may be harder for O'Malley to get reelection.
And I find it, Doug, intriguing. And as you said, this is in many ways very inside baseball. I find all of this intriguing. But I find it also interesting that it appears that Anthony Brown's profile has changed. He was very much our leader on BRAC. He was very, and a lot of that has to do with the economy and a lot of other things that have kind of taken center stage. But his profile has, it seems, in my observation, to have begun to become lower in this administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he's a lieutenant governor, and it's kind of hard to be a high-profile lieutenant governor in Maryland.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things to kind of think about is that virtually every lieutenant governor has probably gone through this kind of rumor mongering about what they're going to do for the reelection campaign.
Right.
And before Steele decided to run for Senate, these kinds of stories were being written. The same was true for
Kathleen Kennedy.
For Kathleen. Mm-hmm. Mickey Steinberg lived it.
And died by it, right.
So part of this, as much as it's fun to write about and track down, you have to recognize that, this is probably part of the normal ebb and flow of politics. Come November, everything that the people are saying that, he's going to be part of the campaign is probably going to come true. But, you've got a guy who, he's trained in, he's from Harvard Law. He served in the Iraq War. You got to imagine that his ambition and his ego is probably bumping up against being number two in the state. Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're talking about here is something I'd like to look into more. I'm fascinated by the idea of his running for Prince George's County Executive. That's a very interesting scenario. I could see how that could unfold into a huge political battle, knowing the politics of that county. That would not be an easy campaign for him.
Well, it may not be easy, but it certainly probably could, feed what it is he's in public service for, assuming that,
right.
he's probably got, what I get from Anthony Brown, he's got a pretty decent ego, and he's a politician, and he probably wants to be in public service to do something. Mm-hmm. And Prince George's County is exactly the place to be for that kind of mindset.
Yeah. You've got, that's the truth.
Well, I mean, you've got... the hospital system that
right.
is, I guess it's still up for sale.
Right.
Still kind of lurching forward. You've got a school system that's got a a new headline almost every week. You've got the issues of crime that just about every place has. I mean, it's the Anthony Brown that I've seen in action is probably thirsting to tackle that kind of job, and so I can imagine him. One afternoon out on the deck having a beer with one of his political buddies saying, that's where I belong. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what the genesis of this is. But, certainly it's people are saying that he's thirsting for something else.
And the interesting thing, Mark, would be this idea of Anthony Brown running for Prince George's County Executive. It gives Martin O'Malley an opportunity to offer full-blown support, campaign with, and it gives him some cover with African-American voters in the state also, who would be troubled, I think, by the removal of an African-American from
yeah.
the ticket.
Mm-hmm. That was my number one skepticism about this rumor
yeah.
as I was hearing it, because, you know, race and politics in Maryland is so finely balanced. And I think one of the virtues of the O'Malley Brown ticket was that it did balance those issues pretty well. And for Anthony Brown to walk away from the reelection, there's going to have to be it had to be good reason for him to do it.
This has been a pleasure having you on the air with us. I hope you'll come for a longer time and join us for some roundtables and say politics.
Sure.
And I mean it that we weren't just blowing smoke. We said the Gazette is the finest paper in the state covering our state politics. We appreciate you being there.
As well as business, Mark. It's an incredible business journal as well. Yeah. They do incredible work, and Doug's a great writer.
Doug Tallman, thanks so much.
Sure.
Douglas Tallman is Annapolis bureau chief for the Gazette. Go on the web and check it out. If you don't know the paper, it's really an insightful paper. We've had a lot of comments, by the way, Anthony, on this healthcare thing. Let me go to the phones and get a couple of calls in here before we have to switch gears in the top of the hour. But many people have written in. Sheldon Laskin wrote in saying the public option is so horrendous, doomed to failure, that the Finance Committee may have done us a huge favor.
Wow.
Patty Archuleta wrote in saying, most unfortunate but hardly unavoidable, considering the current political climate, my fear is that this vote further empowers those whose antics are so right of center. Julia Jackson McCready wrote in saying, pitiful. Mike Barrett wrote in saying they love their jobs. That's why they voted it down. Majority of their constituents didn't want it.
It's true of like Senator Lincoln in Arkansas and some of the other Ben Nelson in Florida. They have some very strong conservative voters in their states.
Ned Humphrey said, saw it coming. The bill is now an abortion, in my view, and Obama should not sign it. No reform is better than this reform. Let's get a couple of calls in here before we move into the rest of this program. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, and talking about abortion, that's what they're trying to, the right to have an abortion paid for by insurance companies is one of the things they are trying to take out from this bill, these bills. We need to spend an hour on that. 410-319-8888. Len, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. I join the outrage with folks who, are upset about the defeat or the weakening of the public option. But I'm kind of uncomfortable just jumping on the Democrats without looking to our own role, the folks who supported the president, the folks who campaigned and worked hard to convince others to go his way. I think we became demobilized, and there was no better indication of that than the town hall meeting that Senator Cardin called in Towson. The progressive forces, the folks who support a public option or even single payer, were just almost non-existent. So, I certainly agree with criticisms of a lot of the Democrats, but I think this is a democracy, and we need to look at the role of the folks who work so hard to elect Barack Obama. So thanks very much for your show.
I appreciate you being part of it today as well. 410-319-8888, a quick thought from Mark in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, have a, go ahead. Quick thought.
What we're seeing is just the proof of the depths of corruption and greed. I mean, this bill that's being considered right now, aside from the fact that it seems to benefit the insurance companies, the fact is that it won't even kick in until if I heard correctly by one person, it was something like
2013.
Right. So I mean, you're talking about, it's really a slap in the face to the citizens of this country. One that is kind of watered down, and then two, it won't really become effective in for years, and then on top of that, what do you do for those people who are really counting on having some kind of health insurance, and their very lives depend on having some kind of insurance? It's really just absolutely pathetic.
Mark, thank you so much for your thoughts. I deeply appreciate you being part of the show as well. To conclude with this, Kate Powell wrote in on Facebook, it would be a challenge for healthcare to be affordable without a public option. I suspect the final bill will need to exempt more people from a mandate in order to stay under Obama's $900 billion threshold. And that, conversely, will save less in the long run. Ah, Washington. So I want to thank you all for writing in and calling in. We're going to take a very short break. And when Anthony McCarthy and I return, we're going to tackle an issue that's really on a lot of our minds, which is this swine flu. And is it an epidemic? Is it not an epidemic? Do we need to get vaccinated or do we don't need to get vaccinated? What's the real truth about what's going on medically and in our public health? We'll be tackling that when we return. I remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back.